Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Publisher Lab. My name is Terrence Timmons, and today I'm joined here with my colleague and friend, Connor Brook. How's it going, Connor?
Doing great, Terrence. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We also have our beloved Manny on the show. How are you doing today, Manny?
Doing good. Good to be back.
So we'll go ahead and get into the show. We have a few interesting stories we want to go into. The first one will cover a bit of the digital ad spend and how that's happening in the economy. Next, we'll go into some changes with Google Search and some of their core web vitals. Should be interesting. We hope this episode has what you're looking for in terms of that. So to lead us away, Manny, you want to knock us off with our first story, worldwide ad spend growth?
Yeah, let's jump right into it. So worldwide ad spending is on the brink of a significant upturn in 2024. It's expected to grow nearly 10% across digital media, traditional media, and total media ad spending. This comes after a remarkable rebound in 2021, where total media ad spending surged by 21.8% due to the recovery from the 2020 pandemic-induced slowdown. Digital ad spending is set to lead the charge, projected to constitute nearly 70% of the global ad spend in 2024 and increasing to almost 75% by 2027. Traditional ad spending is also anticipated to have a strong year, buoyed by macroeconomic conditions, landmark events like Summer Olympics and the UEFA Euro 2024, and a spike in political ad spending in the United States. Every region around the world is expected to witness enhanced ad spending growth in 2024, with Southeast Asia being a notable exception with expected deceleration. So this is some pretty good news for publishers who are looking to have their ad revenue increase here in 2024.
Yeah, I would say this is a breath of fresh air.
100%.
We have just gone through a period of down ad rates. It's been a roller coaster. Like, to put things in perspective a little bit, we had a huge down or a huge up year the year before the pandemic, then a huge down year then when the pandemic hit. And then after the pandemic hit, we had like a flat year and then a huge boom year, which was 2021. And then we went down again 2022 and then stayed down 2023. And now finally the expectations are going up. So I guess it's been a roller coaster of emotions. I don't know if you have any experience talking to other fellow publishers about how they've experienced these ad rates and what this news means to, I guess, some of those clients you've talked to.
Yeah, I would definitely say in the publishing space in the last couple of years, especially during COVID, tend to where we are now. It's just like as you were kind of explaining, it's definitely been very much of a roller coaster. So I think seeing what we've been, that digital ad spend is supposed to be outpacing pretty significantly what it was doing last year, and also traditional media also growing by a couple percentage points is a really good sign, especially for a publisher out there too. And I think there's a lot of reasons to be excited, especially in 2024 for these reasons, especially to be a little bit more bullish and things to kind of have a nice bounce back. And I think a lot of conversation is just making sure that like, hey, you know, even though it's been like a really bit of a roller coaster, that this is going to be a more of an upturn year, especially with a lot of analysts and what people are kind of projecting right now.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting though, is when you look into the actual numbers. So it says, hey, we're going to have an expected growth of 10% in 2024. Interestingly, if you look at Google's Q4 earnings reports, and they're actually up 11% quarter or year over year when you compare Q3 2022 to Q3 2023. Mm-hmm. So part of these expectations could be in fact, taken from Google's performances and probably added into this. Another interesting thing is, you know, we're coming to a big election year. So I see that as a huge driver of this ad spend. You know, we also have the Summer Olympics. But like, for example, UEFA Champions League happens every year. So to me, that's like a, you know, something that's continuously happening.
Right.
But U.S. election happens every 4 years. And most ad rates are in, you know, are driven by United States ad spend dollars. So I see that as being the major contributor. And then also on the side note, we have, it's supposed to rise globally, which is nice. So, you know, countries with historically low ad rates, we have, you know, Latin America countries, India, at least from my job experience, those usually have lower ad rates. So this is saying, hey, those regions are going to increase, but it's saying not Southeast Asia. So if you traffic in there, it's basically, you know, kind of the same. So for those publishers, you know, the outlook maybe isn't as good, but I guess for the United States and everyone else, it's looking great.
So Terrence, if you're like a publisher out there and maybe you have a variety of different niches that you like write content on, how do you expect that it's going to affect like maybe a certain niche over the other when it comes to these kind of more bullish things, but especially like with the political ad spend? How do you think it like varies by niche?
Yeah, so how I see it is, this is like a general rule of thumb. It's not exact, but it matches the picture decently. So what I mean is, so you have a niche of a site. Let's take automotive, right? Let's say you write about cars, or maybe you have a form that talks about like, you know, a specific type of car like Hondas, right? Well, the chances are people going to that site are probably interested in that topic or product. So interested in Honda cars. So then more likely Honda will have ads on that site, right? Because, you know, if you're on a Honda forum, you're probably like Honda cars. So you're probably a good user to be targeted.
Right.
So how I see it is, if you then individualize each niche and then look at how those companies are spending their ad budget. So how is the automotive industry spending ad budgets? If it's really high right now, then I will see that niche doing well. So I relate the niche of your site to the item product, and then I relate it to the company that manages those budgets for advertising. And if those budgets are going up, then I'm like, okay, great. You know, you're in a great spot. So historically speaking, the, you know, the industries that do the best are the ones that make the most money. So like financial, real estate, automotive, business, those type of niches always end up doing well because those economies are usually always spending money on advertising.
Yeah, well said.
All right, and we move on to some Google news because Google has a big date coming up, because on March 12, 2024, Google will introduce a significant update to its core web vitals. The current metric is first input delay, which measures the time from the user's first interaction with a page to the browser's response, will be replaced by interaction to next pane. INP aims to provide a more accurate evaluation of a web page's responsiveness by using data from the Event Timing API, capturing a broader range of user interactions. This update will be incorporated into Google Search Console later this year and signals Google's ongoing commitment to enhance web usability. Website owners and SEOs who have traditionally focused on optimizing FID will need to pivot their strategies towards improving INP scores. Do you guys have any advice for publishers who are just about to get focused on all this new INP stuff coming up?
Yeah, I would say that anytime Google rolls something out, you know, a lot of people tend to freak out a lot, whatever is like, oh, this new initiative. And just remember, if you have a good content, and if overall you're interacting with your site and it feels good to you, then most likely things are fine in the first place. But just a little bit to emphasize on how IMP is going to be in comparative first input delay. It's definitely a lot more robust, and you know, Google doesn't roll out things for no reason. The whole point is to make sure that inner activity on the page when users are clicking on it, instead of measuring one session, it's one click. It's basically measuring all the clicks throughout the page on average is the metric. So at the end of the day, this is like really a more robust way to make sure that users are having a good quality experience when they're interacting with different things on your page. So if you're a publisher out there that's seeing this and kind of questioning like, oh, like, is this good for me? This is really good for users, because at the end of the day, it's helping have a better understanding of like how quality the experience is for the user.
Yeah, 100% agree. And just to reiterate on that point a little bit, you know, this is looking at all the interactions on a web page. So clicks you mentioned, but also taps on your screen, and then keyboard strokes too on your keyboard. So it kind of takes the whole picture into account, while FID was just this first click, you know, first input, right? Which was, you know, kind of like not the best gauge, because you want to have interaction through the whole experience. So I agree. And this is like a step in the right direction for Google actually focusing on metrics that actually relate to user experience rather than some random speed index score. Because, you know, I'm sure you can relate, you know, talking to publishers, you know, spending, you know, thousands of dollars, you know, on a developer and having them, you know, optimize their site for a PageSpeed Insight score, but then their traffic doesn't go up. It's like, what's the return on that investment?
Absolutely.
So, you know, my takeaways is on the speed metrics are, you know, look at the actual definition of this and then see how this relates to user experience on your page. So in this case, this could be like a user clicking on a drop-down menu and it takes like 2 seconds to go. So they might have to click multiple times and maybe it's frustrating. That will be the user experience part that you should consider, as long as your site, you know, is, has all that, I guess, JavaScript and CSS not being blocked by stuff and it just flows cleanly. Nothing to worry about. Focus on your content, right? Focus on the things that are going to have positive ROI on your business. Don't spend, you know, developer thousands of dollars and get no return out of this if, you know, if your site already is smooth to begin with. So really look at the definition of the metric. Look at your site, go around some top pages, interact with it and see how it is. And then look at the metrics and ask yourself, should this be something I want to invest in? And my guess is probably not in most cases. But, you know, if it's really bad and is causing problems, then yeah, go and fix it.
100%. Yeah. And just to piggyback off that, I agree with everything that you're saying, too. Just there's a plethora of information of like how to what IMP is, if you want to like know more how it relates to your site. Google's put out a lot of good information and articles on the web about it. And also, if you partner with Ezoic, it's actually, we have support articles about it, and it's already part of our Leap dashboard, too, that kind of gives different ways how to combat and make IMP better, too. So if you're kind of out there and thinking like, hey, how do I, you know, improve this, or would I want to learn more about it? There's a ton of information on a variety of ways out there of IMP.
Yeah. And just lastly, just touch on the whole site speed thing with the website. Yes, site speed is important, but I think a lot of things get lost in the sauce, right? You know, the most common thing I've seen in my experience in publishing is someone will send me a page speed insights report that has a number that's in red, and it would be, why is my site slow? And they attribute the red number on this report to a site being slow. And to me, that, you know, has always been a pain point, because when I go to the site, I'm like, oh, your website has caching. Your website is responsive. It works perfectly for me on my US internet, on my Chrome browser, on my desktop. I don't see anything wrong. But this report is telling me there's something wrong, so then I must go and fix it, right? So I always bring it down to, imagine you're a user on your site, play with your site. If everything flows smoothly and it's clean to interact with, then you are in a great spot. And you know, that means you probably don't spend much time focusing on speed. Instead, use that time to focus on content and building your business.
Yep.
That's excellent advice, guys. And then also, just to piggyback on the whole having information on IMPs, if you're curious about IMPs and how they work, our colleague Sarah Cloud did post a great blog article on Ezoic's blog regarding IMP. I'll make sure to link it in the description as well. But moving from Google News about Core Web Vitals to Google News about their search generative experience, Google's CEO Sundar Pichai has outlined the company's vision for the future of search, marking the beginning of the Gemini era. This phase is characterized by the integration of the search generative experience and the deployment of Gemini, a series of models aimed to elevating Google's search capabilities. While SGE is under ongoing testing to potentially become the default search experience, Gemini Ultra is set to tackle more complex tasks and introduce paid models. Google is also exploring ads that are native to the SGE environment, which have shown success beyond search. Google envisions its technology acting as an agent for users, with plans to incorporate generative AI into Google Assistant and other AI-powered tools like Circle to Search, Lens, and Bard. So it seems like Google is definitely ramping up using AI in their search generative experience. And we were talking before the show, and you guys mentioned that you guys have become a little bit more familiar with SGE. And I wanted to get your guys' take on it, and whether you think that this is something that is kind of as groundbreaking as they keep coming out and talking about it like it is.
Didn't you say you were playing with some Bard before this?
Yeah, I was actually playing with Bard right before the call. And, you know, I think like a lot of people out there, myself included, I'm definitely use ChatGPT daily and pretty much in all my tasks too. So I was very excited to see kind of testing out Bard and see what the kind of capacity and kind of understanding of the internet and actually gave it a test of if you guys, anyone knows Patrick Mahomes out there, the Kansas City Chiefs quarterback. I asked who Mahomes is and basically gave me his whole history, everything about him, statistics.
Were the statistics accurate?
And the statistics are accurate. Okay. I checked it too. And if anyone's been following the Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift dating,
yeah.
I did ask who Travis Kelce was dating and actually gave a whole timeline of their relationship. So what's really interesting is that pretty intuitive, gave good details, and it is also giving relevant topics within, you know, the last, what, a couple months already too. Yeah. So basically, you know, I'll pass it over to you, Terrence, but Google is investing a lot of time, money, and resources to create a really powerful tool that is going to entice users to come to them.
Yeah, I know in the past we haven't really said the nicest things about Bard. We've always been ChatGPT fans because it just worked better. But it's starting to seem Google stepping up their game a little bit here, you know, improve results. But I think what you mentioned, which was important, was it kind of understood intention a little bit. Mm-hmm. So when you ask it Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift's, you know, or what's Travis Kelce's relationship status, it gives you their timeline of it. And that's probably what most people are interested in, is because most people already know they're dating. I imagine that.
Right.
Unless you're really under a rock. But, you know, that timeline sounds like a proper result to that query. Right. Sure. So how I see this is, you know, Google's definitely doubling down on having a generative search experience within their search results. And they're really trying to expand on this. So a couple points I want to bring up from this earnings call is, the first one is they mentioned their search results, you know, from their generative search experience. They said it's gotten better on specific queries than traditional search. So that means is, as a user, you know, if you type something in Google, like, you know, pizza near me, right? It'll give you a list of restaurants, right? But there are certain queries, maybe, hey, I have a family of four. I need a meal idea on a Tuesday night and I'm low on time, right? A question like that will pop in search, and the generative search results will give you an answer that's better than a traditional query in that sense. So I think what it does is it's going to also open the door for new volume of search queries, right? You know, you will still have your traditional queries where it's just simple phrases like pizza near me, but now you can go very specific too. And I think that that new volume of queries is going to open a door for other sites to pop in as a recommendation in there. And then hopefully Google gives you a link, but we don't actually know if there's any data on a user clicking a link in that search result and going to a site, you know,
yeah,
from the answer it gives you. So I definitely see this as, you know, things are opening up and things are getting better in this regard. And Google is definitely doubling down on it. And it's definitely going to be something in the future that publishers have to keep in mind when they are creating content optimized for Google search.
Yeah, I agree with you. Just one of the biggest questions that really prompts in my head is, how is this going to affect organic search? Because let's say I put the simplest query, like, what color is the sky? And,
yeah,
you know, SGE can basically just say, oh, the sky is blue, and kind of give you a couple lines of AI description. And maybe before, someone actually would click through into a URL and go like, oh, I'm going to go figure out why the sky is blue or what color, yeah, it is. So I'm very curious to see how that's going to play, because if I'm a publisher out there that's relying heavily on Google traffic, which I know a large percentage of publishers do, like, I would definitely want to make sure I'm protecting my nest egg in my business, that I'm still getting my fair share of Google traffic.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And how I would approach this is, look at, I guess, the most popular queries that your site currently ranks for. So go into your Google Search Console data, pull up your queries, throw that into Google Search, you know, with what their generative search is giving you, see what the answer is, and then see if there's any way you can make your stuff that has a unique spin on it compared to theirs. Mm. Now, what I mean by that is, so a large language model, whole point is to predict the next word in a sentence, right? So what that means is it's going to take a bunch of data from the internet. So let's use an example. Let's say you're writing a blog about Honda cars, right? And it's going to look at, you know, all this data from websites about Honda cars, right? Then you ask it a question like, what is the best 2021 Honda car, right? Then it's going to spit out an answer. That answer is going to be an average of all of the content it's just read, right? So what this means is you can make your content more specific. You can say, hey, you know, I'm going to put it in my unique perspective, or I'm going to put it in a unique way that this average won't be able to do. So I think the edge as a content creator, which I will think about, is your uniqueness is going to be the edge, and leverage that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, ChatGPT can get kind of vanilla sometimes. Of course, this can change in the future if they start bringing in personalized data into search. But I think there's a vanilla aspect that can be taken advantage of.
Yeah. Well said. And I think just always staying like really competitive in the industry, and just always like, there's always going to be a huge influx of content, especially now with all the AI models too. So I think just if you're out there and a publisher, just keep on differentiating yourself and staying competitive within your landscape, just because 100%. Anything that can be easily duplicated, you most likely be losing organic search traffic.
Yeah. I think also we're way past the days where you can just, you know, throw a website on WordPress, throw some content up and hope to rank. That just doesn't work anymore.
You might rank, but it might be, you know, page five or six.
Page five or six. Yeah, exactly. If you want content, you got to run it like a business nowadays.
Sure.
And I think that is sort of what we're seeing with things getting more competitive. Google slowly chipping away at that search volume, right? They want to have those feature snippets. They want to have their own little boxes. So it's, how do you make yourself unique? So you got to really take that business standpoint.
And I mean, just to kind of piggyback off of what you guys are saying, looking at this from like a publisher perspective, like you mentioned, if you're looking at this like a business, this is extremely concerning from a publisher aspect, because not only is Google making this a more dominant thing in their search platform, mm-hmm. but they're even planning on putting ads next to it.
Yeah.
So when you hear, oh, we're putting ads next to it, that means obviously people are loving it. And from a consumer perspective, someone who uses Google on a daily basis and has used this SGE feature, I love it. It's great. You know, there's no issues. I'm still, you know, not 100% sold on Bard, but you guys, you know, convinced me to give it another try. The last time I tried it, it was just, you know, it was slow. It wasn't great, but, you know, it's only improved since then. But seeing them as saying that we're going to have a plan to put ads here, that's like, oh, okay. They're not only going to continue to flood people into just the SGE experience and away from other websites, but now they're just going to start monetizing off of that as opposed to using other people's content to then monetize off of them.
Yeah. So, you know, putting myself in Google's shoes for a little bit here, you know, Google makes all of its revenue. I think it's 65% from Google search ads. So that's literally just ads in your search result. That's 65% of the revenue, right? Huge amount. So they have to protect that revenue as much as possible while still staying ahead of the competition. So in this earnings call, Google CEO was like, hey, we're going to find ways to incorporate advertisements into the actual result of the generative search experience. So an example I think they gave was, hey, let's say you're like, I need a gift recommendation for my sister. She's into these topics and interest. What some examples of, you know, what can I get her, right? So traditionally, ChatGPT will list some items. Then I bet what they're going to do is they're going to link those items with existing purchase items in Google search. You know how if you search for an item, you get those little card blocks?
Yep.
They're going to then take those and match it with the result and then pop them in there. So it's going to be links to purchase.
Yep.
And, you know, Google's in a very unique position where they can leverage that because they have basically all Amazon search results, all Shopify search results, all third-party search results in these little card boxes with a price and a link and an image and a description. So they can easily just match that into a search experience. However, this limits it to a certain number of queries where it's only someone, hey, I want to buy something, right? The queries that are informational or like just looking for a fact or research, it's going to be probably a little bit harder to monetize those segments of traffic, I will say.
Yeah, it's like they already know what you want before you know you want it.
Yeah, exactly. So now no one has an excuse not to get someone a good gift.
Yeah.
No more Amazon gift cards.
Christmas is about to get real tense next year. He's like, what do you mean you didn't get me a good gift? You had Google Gemini to ask.
You can ask an AI and it'll probably do better.
I saw a lot of those tools pop up over the holiday season. Like a gift giving AI, like where you put information in. It never did that good of a job. At least from my experiences, I always had to you know, go through traditional means to find out what give people, but that's definitely something that's going to help out a lot of people next year.
We know this is going to be a problem that's going to get solved soon, so we can stop worrying about
it. That we do know.
All right, and then moving on to our last story of the week, we have some news that is concerning publishers because they're expressing issues with Google's privacy sandbox, particularly the Protected Audiences API, which is crucial for retargeting in a world without third-party cookies. This API is criticized for its limited insight and reporting capabilities, posing challenges for publishers who wish to understand the dynamics of interest groups and the flow of advertising revenue on their platforms. Google's initiative aims to enhance individual privacy by restricting the sharing of audience data between publishers and ad tech vendors, a move that complicates tracking and reporting. The lack of transparency and involvement in the privacy sandbox development has led publishers to call for better sell-side reporting mechanisms. Technical issues such as the absence of standardized methods for data reporting exacerbate these challenges. Publishers and ad tech executives are advocating for collaborative efforts to improve reporting capabilities, seeking to balance privacy concerns with operational transparency and effectiveness. And this seems like an issue that we're only going to hear more of moving forward, especially with the deprecation of third-party cookies. Yeah. Now, if I feel like every time I bring this topic up on the podcast, because it's had several iterations, I get a different response from everybody I ask.
Interesting.
When we had Tyler and John Cole on the show, there was so much cynicism because they were under the impression that they've been saying that third-party cookies are going to be going away for a long time, but they're still here.
Yeah.
But these seem to be more concrete movements towards really getting rid of third-party cookies. How do you guys think that publishers should fare with all of this?
Yeah, so just to provide a little bit of context, Google is right now currently testing 1% of Chrome traffic with no third-party cookies, and they have a privacy sandbox available for publishers to use to look at results of this, albeit there's concerns over the quality of these results. So it looks like it's finally happening, and this was always something that was like kept getting kicked down the road further and further, and now it's finally starting to get some traction. Now the problem is, number one, of course, this is a complicated issue, but also how this reporting works is, right now with Google's privacy sandbox, they say you can see data like you have label 1, label 2, label 3, and those are just labels. So for that type of traffic, they will still get everything in Chrome. They'll have all their third-party cookies, etc. And then they have ones called treatment 1, treatment 2, treatment 3. I think it's actually like 1.1, 1.2, but that's besides the point. And then that will have like a version of Chrome with no third-party cookies, a version of Chrome with third-party cookies, and then certain APIs are restricted from, and then one where a group of publishers can decide what they put into the box. Mm. So number one is there's, you know, different ways you can see this reporting, and then one of the boxes was you need collaboration from other groups, but that turned out to be pretty hard, so it kind of was just redundant. But anyways, this is basically, in my understanding, is saying, hey, you know, if you're a publisher, you won't be able to share data back, or no, if you're an advertiser, you won't be able to have that data shared between the publisher and the advertiser or the ad tech vendor. So basically, there's going to be a blind spot where if you're a publisher, you can't see it, and then if you're an advertiser, they won't be able to see it either. And that blind spot is leading to transparency issues and, of course, poor reporting capabilities, so people can't see, like, clear ROI. Hey, without cookies, this is how much Chrome users will make with ads. With third-party cookies, this is how much they'll make, etc. So I think that's at the crux of this issue.
No, Terrence, is it only 1% of the users can actually run these ABC tests?
No. So right now it's being run on all 1% of Chrome users regardless.
Okay.
But publishers can get access to this privacy sandbox to then see this data in that reporting format.
Do they apply for it, or how do they get to get access?
They apply for it, okay, and then they get access. Yeah. So for example, like the company I work at is we got our reporting access, so then we can see it and we can see the results of that on that data.
So I guess, what do you think Google's trying to accomplish by having 1% of users be able to test the privacy sandbox? Like, what do you think their ultimate goal is? Is this like a sample size of like what's going to come in the future so they kind of know how to approach it?
I think it's, you know, I would like to be on the optimistic side, and I think they're giving us tools to sort of, you know, adjust business models and data tracking to basically solve these problems before they actually, you know, hit reality. When, let's say, there's a world where Chrome is 100% cookieless, right? So saying, hey, here's an experiment that's being run. You can see the results of it. Go make adjustments. But what Google's kind of doing is they're just saying, here's what it looks like. Go fix it. You know, go fix on your end, right? You know, have publishers go work with their sell side partners to get better reporting or enable better tracking between the two. It's not like Google saying, here's our solution. It's just kind of like, here's what's going to happen. Kind of fix it. But I'm still of the belief that, you know, right now, if you run this test, this is in a world where there are third-party cookies, so you have elevated rates in Chrome, then you make a test where you have no third-party cookies, and the rates will look lower, right? But if you have a world where there is no third-party cookies to begin with, those ad dollars won't vanish alongside that. So then I'm of the opinion that the rates will still stay the same when you go into that world.
I have a question for you too. How do you feel? Do you think Google actually wants to maintain more or full transparency with publishers? Or do you think that they're doing this because they have to?
Probably because they have to. And, you know, think about it, right? We've had this massive push towards privacy in the past, you know, how many years, right? So I feel like Google's kind of just being forced into caring about this. In reality, they probably, if they could choose and still be profitable, they just want to do it, right? So I feel like they're kind of being pushed into having this privacy focused way to deal with cookies, and they're maybe hoping someone else can help solve this problem a little bit for them. I'm sure they have their own solutions for their ad stuff, but again, most of their advertising comes from the ads and search results, not on publisher sites.
Right.
That is still a good chunk of the revenue, which they will want to protect, but it's not like the most. So, you know, they'll care more about generative AI right now, then this will be like a second priority.
Awesome. So that's the stories that we got on the docket for this week, guys. Thanks again for being on the show this week. Terrence, you're basically, you know.
Yeah, I'm like the host now.
Yeah, you are.
Tell Tyler.
No, I won't tell him. He's just on a bit of a, he's been out for a while. So yeah. He'll be back soon, and we'll have both of you guys on the show. Just before we say our goodbyes, I just want to do a little bit of housekeeping. We do, if you guys love these news shorts or these news stories that we cover, we get a lot of stories in throughout the week that we have our good friend Connor Porter doing reports on every single week. We put those together as shorts and post them on YouTube and social media. Make sure to check those out. Any last send-offs from you guys before we close out the Publisher Lab this week?
You know, here in San Diego, it's pouring rain, so we're going to try to stay dry. It's been another great episode. Thanks for joining me, Connor.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Great episode, and hope you guys found something useful and information today.
We're going to need to use Gemini to come up with some really cool catchphrases. We'll have those on in the next few episodes.
Yeah, and then we'll, you know, hopefully have a day where we stop talking about Google.
Yeah, I don't think that day's going to happen for a while.
Probably not. Thanks for joining, everybody.